I mean, one of the things that I love so much about this job is that there's never an answer that works for everyone.
No job requirements.
Other questions?
And you were talking about judging your first book awards and Elizabeth having done a lot of writing workshops. But I wondered if there was one sort of maybe overarching or one or two things that you see most beginning writers sort of miss out on in their work, you know, if it's characters or plot or...
When I taught at Iowa, I taught with, sometimes I overlapped with Chris Offutt, and Chris once said to me, you know, how do you tell your students what they should write about? You know, how do you put it? And I said, I would never tell my students what to write about. You know, I just, you know, that's not my place. I had, that semester, I had a student who was a wonderful writer, but she hadn't found her material yet. She hadn't found, I think what you need to write a really interesting piece of fiction is some sort of obsession with the material. Some sort of, whether it is an obsession with the inner life of a particular character or with this, even if it's just the subject matter of what you're writing about, the background or the place or the setting, some sort of specific obsession. And this young woman who's in my class was the best writer in the class, and yet she did not write the best stories because somehow she only wrote about stuff that she was passingly interested in. She somehow had not found the material that would really engage her. And I do think that when I was reading for Provincetown, the things that always rose to the top were the things where there was something beyond just the situation of these two characters and this, whatever particular difficulty was between them. There was some interest in the material. And for me, even when I'm just reading for pleasure, that as well is what I look for. And I also know from the writing side of it that when my writing is not going well, one of the times when I was being a very inefficient writer was my second novel, which is about a vaudeville comedy team. The first draft did not have a vaudeville comedy team in it. And I thought I was going to write the great Jewish Iowa novel because I felt that there was a niche there that I could fill. It was wide open for me, based on all of these family stories, my mother's family. And I did a lot of research, and I was, you know, there. I read The Jews of Iowa, A Century of Iowa Jewry, and The Jews of Des Moines. And I was really, you know, I would say, you know, to my mother, did you know there used to be a matzah factory in downtown Des Moines on West 9th Street? But the problem was I was interested in it, but I was not obsessed with it. And I worked on it for years, and it just never, there were some pretty, pretty sentences in it, but it never sort of leapt into the level that it should. And then I put a comedy team into it, and I was obsessed with vaudeville, and I got more obsessed with vaudeville, and I then wrote the first draft. I never got a first draft of that novel. I had about 180 pages that I ended up throwing out. But once vaudeville entered into it, I wrote a first draft pretty quickly. And now when I teach, I think of what Chris said about, you know, how do you tell your students about what to write, and I sort of say to students, all right, that's not my job, but it's something you really have to think about. It's something you really have to think about what kind of relationship you're going to have. In other words, marry for love, not for security, when it comes to writing.
People ask all the time, do you think writing can be taught? People ask you that all the time, and my answer is always, you can teach someone how to write, you can't teach someone how to have something to say. And you're much better off taking a student who really, really has something to say, but has a crummy style, because you can teach that, than somebody who has a razor blade perfect style, but really is an empty soul. And the person that I know that speaks most eloquently on this, although I have to say you just did a very good job, is Robert Olin Butler. And I highly recommend Good Scent from a Strange Mountain if you haven't read it. It's a book that I very dearly love. When I talk to Bob, and he talks about teaching and he talks about writing, it just amazes me, and I would love to go back and be his student. He doesn't let his students write at all, his graduate students, until really late in the semester. He doesn't workshop. He says there is absolutely no point in trying to fix something. You can make it a better sentence or talk about the structure or the character or the plot or whatever, but he's like, if it doesn't have a soul, it's never going to have a soul. If somebody doesn't know how to put it in and make that an interesting story and and tap into what they have inside themselves if they're ready to take those emotional risks. Janet Burroway did a collection of his lectures, and it's called Writing from Your Dream Space, and it's just come out. I just got a copy of the book. I could be wrong about the title. It's something like that, but Robert Olin Butler, Writing from the Dream Space, would be a book that I would really recommend looking at because I think that it addresses exactly that issue.
Well, in terms of, you know, having subject matter, which is obviously different from having something to say, I remember with The Magician's Assistant, and you said that you started to write that, and it was about a magician, but you didn't know anything about magic. And so can you talk about, like, at what point you realize you need to do research? I think you said that Elizabeth had said, girl, you need to get some magic tricks in here, or something like that. You know, how do you realize what you're going to research, and how far to go, and when to do it?
That's a funny story, although ultimately I think Elizabeth is much better at the research question. That's a book about a magician and an assistant, but it's magic is not in any way essential to the plot of that novel. It could have been a heart surgeon and a scrub nurse, or any relationship where you have a dominant and a secondary, a dominant and an assistant. And I was working on the book, and I sent Elizabeth the first 100 pages or so, and you said, okay, now this is getting kind of embarrassing. You don't know anything about magic. And I didn't, and I wasn't interested in magic. And my whole understanding of it was really like television shows I'd seen when I was 7. I had never given it any thought, so I stopped. I took several months off to do research, and what I found was that any information you really wanted about magic, you don't have access to. You can read books about magic for the rest of your life, and you're never really going to find out what you want to know because those tricks are sold. And if you buy them, you have to sign papers that say you won't reveal them, and then you'll only sell them. And so you read these books, and it's about the childhood of the magician or how to build a table that you could slip a rabbit into. It's very stupid stuff. But the lesson for me there was really my greatest lesson in writing, which is that it's about authority. And magic is completely and totally about domination and authority. And fiction writing is completely about domination and authority. That you present yourself as someone who knows what they're doing. And you control the room. And you have to control the reader. And that, in fact, I had to be able to write a trick that was impossible and that wasn't true in such a way that would make the reader believe that it was true. And that's the whole process of fiction writing in a way, too. And that you go through life, go to any party, go to any wedding on a Saturday night in New York City, wear the right suit, get the right dress, go into any wedding with your shoulders back and your head up, and nobody's going to ask you who you are. And that's writing. And people come up to me all the time and say, oh, you must be a pianist, you must be an opera singer, you must be a magician, you must have been pregnant in Kentucky, you must have done this and this. And I'm like, you know, my job is to create a make-believe world and to make you believe that it's true. That's professionally what I do for a living. And people are bizarrely unwilling to accept that. You don't have to know anything. You just have to have authority.
Well, there are a lot of different ways you can know something. I don't think that The Magician's Assistant would have worked as well with a surgeon.
No, it wouldn't have. But it's not a book about magic, per se.
But it still works as a metaphor for the relationships. And Elizabeth, actually, I think, didn't The Giant's House and The Magician's Assistant come out sort of close to each other? You have some magic in The Giant's House. James is interested in tricks and Houdini.
What's the publication of The Magician's Assistant?
I think Magician's Assistant was before.
What year was it?
No. I mean, I think Giant's House was before Magician's Assistant.
I think that's right.
I think so. I think if anything, I got magic from you.
Well, no, I think we're both. We have discussed. There are certain things that the other person can't write about that much. Mm-hmm. Like I can never write. It is possible that if I hadn't known Anne, I would have written a book about a magician someday because there's tiny, tiny bits of magic in The Giant's House. But now I can't, and Anne said at one point, you know, I'd love to write a book about a comedy team, but pretty much off the list for her, too.
Life is still full.
Yes.
Other questions?
Could you both talk a little bit about when you're going through your first draft and you're first sitting down to start working on either a short story or a novel? Do you sweat and toil over each sentence as you go along, or do you just sort of like, I want to get as much out on a piece of paper as I possibly can and then go back and look at it later? Are you constantly revising, or do you go back, you know, do you want to set it away for a little while before you go back to revise?
It's real Alan Gerganis. That immediately when you said that, I thought about Alan and that idea of get it on the page. I'm a big believer in that. Now, I'm incredibly slow and frustrate myself terribly these days especially, but I think to toy around with a sentence and make a perfect sentence is bordering on ridiculous. And it's just a stall. In the same way that research can be the most fantastic stall
it's
in the
awesome.
World.
My favorite stall. Really.
Research can be a lot like doing drugs after a while. No, I think you're much better off to write something and write to learn, not just in terms of process, but also in terms of how do you learn. Write it, look at it, work on it, go on, go on, go on. Don't keep cutting the same diamond. You know, make a glass, smash it, make a glass, smash it.
I mostly agree with it, and I agree with it entirely in theory. I'm sort of in between. Our friend Paul Lisicki, who's a wonderful writer, and also a musician, once told me that when he writes, because he's so attuned to the noise, he sometimes will put in nonsense syllables because he understands what a sentence should sound like, but he might not have the right words. And that was one of the moments I just looked at him and think, you're crazy. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard of.
I heard Phil Collins say that once.
Really?
Yeah, I did.
Paul and Phil have a lot in common.
That's right.
And while I do not toil and sweat over every sentence, because I do think you could spend the rest of your life writing the first page of any novel or any short story, and by God, there are people who do exactly that, that I have a hard time writing what seems to me to be a bad sentence. I can, in first drafts, have no problem being sketchy about exactly what the character does for a living, as Anne knows. She's always saying, your characters seem to be utterly unemployed. Where do they get their money?
Or their health insurance.
Their
I'm
health
always
insurance.
Worried about their health insurance.
I always say, I feel the same way about my family. It's never hard to ask. I can be quite loose about, and you know, even sort of think, well, I'm going to make this person Catholic for the moment, but that might change. Things that other people would definitely know before they went into something. But when it comes to language, I cannot go forward if I think I have written a bum or sloppy sentence. When I'm first writing something, I'll start every day by reading aloud what I did beforehand until it becomes too burdensome to do that. And I do a lot of revising, besides all the revising I do later on, I do a lot of revising as I go along. And it is true that I therefore have to be really vigilant, that I am not simply, you know, polishing the same square of glass over and over and over again.
It also depends on what drives your work. Because I think your work is so much more language-oriented than mine. Your sentences are so beautiful. Whereas I'm a very plot-oriented person. And I'm, you know, I write like a train. And, okay, but then this happens, this happens, this happens. I was watching Wallace and Gromit shorts the other night. They're really fabulous. The Wrong Trousers take 30 minutes out of your life. But there's this incredible scene where Gromit, who's the dog, is on a toy train being shot at by the evil penguin. And the train track divides and he's out of track and Gromit picks up the box of track and he's, as fast as he can, he's laying the track in front of the train that he's on. And that's how I feel when I'm writing. I'm there just as fast as I can, putting out the direction. And that's what's always really important to me. I write some really crappy sentences along the way.
I don't know if this at all dovetails with the research question that Suzanne sort of asked before, but do you find yourself gravitating to any sort of novel as you're writing a novel, you know, like a more atmospheric novel if you're writing? You know, like, who do you read as you're writing? Or maybe it's just a question about influences prior to writing, too.
Do we gravitate towards certain... Because there's some writers who don't read anything when they're writing, and who do we read while we're writing?
Yeah, or before. Who can we not read? Like I always say, I can never read Grace Paley.
Oh, yeah, me neither.
Or Alan.
Or Alan, or Raymond Chandler.
I could read Raymond Chandler.
I can't.
Yeah.
It may be because your work is actually close to Raymond Chandler's than mine is, whereas there are already guns and drama in Patchett's novels, whereas there are, you know, when I'm reading Raymond Chandler and all of a sudden it's my novel, it takes place in California with guns and drama, it's noticeable.
Whereas, when the Jews of Des Moines board suddenly, the train.
Suddenly, I squinted over my salami sandwich. I love to read Dickens. I often have said that I have never finished I've never finished a Flannery O'Connor story because she gets me excited about writing for some reason. Besides the fact that I love her work, there is something that makes me kind of think, wow. I often read poetry when I'm writing, especially if I'm having difficulty. For some reason, and this makes no sense, if I'm really frustrated and I cannot write, the book that will always unstick me is the Dream Songs. Mm. I'm the only person that the Dream Songs really cheers up. But for some reason, it massages my brain in the right place and makes me think different, bigger thought. You know, frequently when I'm stuck, it's because my brain is turning in circles that are too tight for the project, and I sort of can't get my head above the level of the book. And poetry, more than anything, I think helps me do that. It's like, you know, a particular kind of physical stretch that fixes things somehow.
I've been reading a lot more nonfiction, and sometimes I wonder if I will, in my life, pass out of fiction completely and then maybe pass out of writing. That's always a really exciting thought to me, that I've grown a lot and changed as a writer in the course of my career, and that I could actually grow out of writing. It makes me really happy. But I do read more and more nonfiction as time goes by, and especially when I'm writing fiction, that feels very safe. I've been on a huge Joan Didion kick lately. I read The Year of Magical Thinking, which is a brilliant book, and I so recommend it to all of you. But it's a very, very sad book, and it's a book about her really wanting to turn back time. And I was able to do that by going back and rereading her early books, most of which I had read, but I just kind of spun out of control and was reading Joan Didion all the time. And she is somebody who not only makes me want to write, but really makes me want to be a certain kind of person, which goes back to the whole thing of what's your moral scope? What's the thing that's drawing you towards writing? And I feel in Didion's work that's so clear. And writers who have seemingly a small space between who they are and what they're doing become more and more valuable to me. And even a writer like Chandler, who I think very much lived his work and lived that life, which is funny, it's not at all the same as autobiography or writing Romana Clef's, but to say that there's a deep connection between what you're feeling, thinking, living, and writing, that's the work that really draws me. So things that inspire me to go back to work at this point in my life are the most valuable. And certainly things that are too voicey that I would love otherwise, I can't read while I'm writing because I pick it up. I'm an incredible mimic. I used to have a boyfriend who Elizabeth couldn't stand, the second one couldn't stand, who now she likes very much. And okay. They knew each other before either one of them knew me. They didn't like each other. Then I dated him. And then after we broke up, they met again and liked each other. Yeah. But whenever I would talk to Elizabeth on the phone, this person would be so irritated with me because he always said for at least 2 hours after I got off the phone with Elizabeth, I would talk like Elizabeth. And I have a really good ear and I pick things up so easily that I have to be careful about reading. But Joan Didion is so clear and clean.
You said earlier that you're very private, pathologically private or something like that. And How does it feel to be interviewed this way?
Kind of sucks.
It's on my question list about privacy.
Kind of sucks. No, that's not true. And certainly Anne knows me well enough not to. We were joking because she was giving me some of the questions she was going to ask me. And I said, no, it'd be much better, you know, to just go in and you can ask me a question. I'll burst into tears and say, I can't believe you asked me that question. Slap. Leave the room. This is delightful. It's fine. But I do have a hard time sometimes, especially if somebody asks me something personal. It was one of the reasons why I liked being a librarian, because nobody cares about the librarian. You just all day long say, how are you? What's new? Nobody really cares. Starts asking you questions back.
One of my favorite lines in The Giant's House is, Peggy feels that no one in town recognizes her without a circulation desk around her waist. It's like a chastity belt or a farthingale or something like that.
And that was, when I was a librarian, that was really, really true, that I would all the time run into my patrons in Somerville, Mass., where I worked, and I would say, hey, how are you? And they would be wary because I was so out of context. They had no notion of who I was.
Your privacy, though, has loosened up.
Yeah,
from when
probably
I,
has.
From when I knew you in your early 20s. You're more relaxed.
Yeah, I probably am.
And what brought about the relaxation?
I can't talk about it.
That's private. Okay. I have one more question, actually. About friendship and being writers, because I had a best friend in a novel workshop, and she'd always write 150 pages to my 50 pages. And I think I'm making a big assumption, maybe I'm the only one who deals with writer's envy, but I was wondering how you deal with writer's envy and being best friends.
Our competition is really, although now our schedules are a little off, so it's not so bad, but we really would have moments entirely just based on how many pages we had written that
yeah.
day.
What, the way you phrased that question, I wrote 50 pages to my friend's 150, that
is... Well, is that Times New Roman or Courier?
Yeah.
Because it makes a difference, you
yeah.
know.
I'm not joking. I mean, it really would get down to that. It was always about productivity yeah. for us. And life does change, and you know, you're living in the country and nobody knows where to find you and you have this quiet life right now. And I get very jealous of that. I think I want to live, if I was living in the countryside of France, I could get this novel finished.
Actually, page and time envy are good jealousies to have.
Yeah.
Any kind of jealousy that spurs you productivity. Success envy is the most useless emotion that exists. And I certainly know writers who have given into it and have sort of scarcely ever written anything good afterwards. Because if you give into it in any way, it uses up the time that you should be writing. So that I always think that if you have a moment where you think, you know, I wish I had that you need to figure out how to, as quickly as possible, convert that impulse into your own work, because otherwise it's so useless. So I, you know, it's good to envy somebody's productivity, because that is something that's, it's an easier conversion process into productivity.
Also, productivity is what you can, to some extent, control, and success is a crapshoot. You know, when something goes really huge and really well, it's not because you've produced a better product. It's because the stars lined up and you'll never know why, and you'll never be able to replicate it again. So to be jealous of something that you can't control and your friend couldn't control is useless. But to say, okay, I'm jealous because you're getting more done.
Or if you read something and say, I wish I had written that sentence.
Yeah.
Sometimes if you follow the other person around long enough and keep saying, done with that sentence? Can I have that sentence? She'll give it to you.
Yeah.
We once did a sentence swap because we so loved a sentence in the other person's work that we just did an even swap of sentences.
And I don't remember What
I remember, I remember the sentence I got from you.
What?
It was like a bright light went through my mother when she was at her best, and it showed up all the other holes in her character. It's not as good in the story as it was in the patron saint of liars.
No memory of that
at
all.
But you were done with it. It was a line that when I read it, tears sprung to my eyes because I was so good, and I happily stuck it in the story. And not exactly took credit for it. If anybody said, you know, I really like that line, I wouldn't ever say, oh, thank you very much. But yeah, I don't remember what you wanted in return.
I wanted the bar of our recent unhappiness. Did I get it? No.
We were once walking down a street in Provincetown, and we had been the night before, and this was early in our friendship, and one of those moments when we knew we were made for each other. We were in a bar discussing Nine Stories, Salinger book, which is certainly one of my favorite books in the world.
Yeah, both of us, yeah.
And we were, you know, just sort of talking about how great all the stories were, and a piano player came.
Transvestite piano bar singer.
Yes.
Threw us out of the bar for discussing which of the Nine Stories was our favorite.
Because we got really loud. She began to play, and
we were just too close to the bar.
And we began to yell louder and louder. And then she said, excuse me, girls, into the microphone. She said, excuse me, girls, I'm going to have to ask you to leave because you're distracting. And then, but the bar had gotten really crowded in the meantime, and we had to work our way back. And she said, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Bye, girls. Bye, girls.
And so the next day, I said, as we passed by, there's the bar of our recent unhappiness. And Anne said, that's
mine.
A great title.
Mine.
I said, mine. No, I said it.
That was a big fight. It was
no,
really
we essentially had a race, and I won. We basically said, whoever writes something that it's a good story for.
But I didn't write stories.
Riley of me, isn't it? But then you took the first line of that story.
I did, that's right, because the first line of the bar of our recent unhappiness was a dog ran into the bar. A dog ran into the bar. And the first line of Taft was the girl walked into the bar. And what was so humiliating was how many reviews of that book mentioned what a great first sentence that was.
Well, it has that kind of Chekhovian, guests arrived for the party.
Right.
That classic.
I always just thought it was like a priest, a rabbi, and the Pope walk into a bar. I like the Chekhovian thing. I mean, that's great, but I think it's...
Everything is stolen. It's just how gracefully you do it, I think.